National Conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the political bureau of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniyeh, warned the Israeli regime against holding the so-called flag march in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the Sword of Al-Quds battle will be a walk in the park compared to any future battles with Palestinian resistance groups. The Zionists must not test our patience, and they must stop their provocations, especially in Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians believe that the Sword of Al-Quds battle has united their ranks. During the 11-day war, all Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip worked together through the Joint Chamber of Military Operations.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinians were united together against the Israeli forces. The Sword of Al-Quds battle exposed the weakness of the Israeli regime. The Palestinian people in Gaza, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied West Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
French cement giant Lafarge has lost their final appeal and will undergo a high-profile trial in a precedent-setting case which could force Western corporations to stop turning a blind eye to terrorism. Lafarge will be tried for complicity in crimes against humanity in Syria. They are accused of working with Daesh terrorist group for years in northern Syria, with the concrete produced in their factory used in battlefield infrastructure, which terrorists needed to keep the unrest going. They will be tried for financing terrorism, for allegedly paying 13 million euros to terrorist groups from 2010 to 2014, supposedly to keep their factory safe. They will also be charged for endangering the lives of others, for putting its 11 Syrian employees at risk. The original suit was brought by French NGO Sherpa on behalf of the workers.
We were surprised by the decision of the Court de Cassation. And this decision is really a victory because we were a bit worried that crimes against humanity would be dropped. But the fact also that on top of that, there is the endangering life of workers that has been maintained is really, I mean, a double victory. So we are super happy, even though we have to remember that it's been 6 years.
After the scandal broke, Lafarge was merged with Swiss giant Holcim, but 8 Lafarge executives will now face justice.
It's the first time that a court decided on crimes against humanity, the first time it's on the mother company for the activities of its subsidiary, especially a subsidiary abroad and foreign workers. It's super interesting for access to justice for victims around the globe. And maybe opening, you know, new avenues for the victims of globalization around the world.
Leaked testimony from the Lafarge executives reveals that the French Foreign Ministry knew the entire time, telling Lafarge to hold on and that everything would work out. The case will likely drag on for years, but longtime political heavyweight and former foreign minister Laurent Fabius may be called on to testify. In 2012, he infamously said that al-Nusra, al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, was, quote, doing good things on the ground, and likely with Lafarge's concrete. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
The drama theater of Mariupol. It is the scene of the alleged single most deadly war crime so far in this brutal conflict. Depending on who you believe, it was either a Russian airstrike or done by the Ukrainians to blame it on Russia. The words children are still scrawled on the pavement outside, written in order to ward off a Russian strike.
I talked to emergency workers a week ago. Our fire brigade is over there, and they told me they found two more dead bodies.
He breaks down and walks away, unnecessarily ashamed of his tears.
I lost everything. What is left for me here? I have worked here all my life.
This is the second time that I've been here in the last few days. Since the last time, there's a little bit more rubble being cleared up. Interestingly, you can just walk straight in, even though it's a crime scene or a former crime scene, and still a site where it's still pretty dangerous in places. But you can walk straight in, it's that easy. But finding out just what happened here is a little harder. At the very least, I wanted to find out just how many people had died here. Estimates range from around 30 to over 600. A workman took me down to the basement, but told me his team had only recovered three bodies from the rubble. He also grumbled that they could have worked much faster if they hadn't been ordered to remove brick by brick, due to, as he called them, fake stories about hundreds underneath. Some eyewitnesses and previous media reports say that there were over 100 outside the theater at a field kitchen. None survived, they said. This is Alexander. He says he was sheltering in a basement nearby and came to the theater the morning after the explosion.
We thought there would be between 500 to 1,000 dead. There are three floors, but only 20 bodies were dug out, which means the others were led out from the theater. Outside, beside the kitchen, there were 15 bodies, thank God.
Witnesses say there was 100 people outside at a food shelter, and they were all killed. Is that what you saw?
No, they only found 20 inside the basement and 15 outside. That's all. We thought that there were 1,000 dead, and we were going around these ruins shouting if there was anyone alive still. There were arms and legs. It's difficult to put it into words.
Alexander also finds it hard to hold back the tears. If this was a Russian strike, it would still constitute a war crime. But have the figures been exaggerated to cause greater uproar?
There's a famous Russian journalist and TV personality. I've spoken to them. They are unsurprisingly very clear that this was a Ukrainian strike to blame on the Russians. But there isn't just a battle on the ground here in Ukraine. There's also a propaganda war as Russia seeks to justify its invasion, and NATO and Ukraine seek to make Russia out to be committing heinous war crimes.
At the nearest hospital, I speak to a medic who was working at the time of the explosion.
Maybe it was a strike from the air. According to another account, it was mined and detonated. I cannot say for sure. It's not clear.
Why couldn't you get to the theater as an ambulance driver?
At that time, the Russian military didn't let us go to the theater. There were battles going on nearby.
If Alexander's testimony is to be believed, and if the workmen are correct about there being few bodies in the rubble, then did the Russians take away hundreds of bodies in the hours after the explosion, in which they took control of the area and before the morning? Possibly. In an honest world, an independent investigation would be carried out to find out what happened and how many people died. But for now, as the war continues to rage, that seems unlikely. As they say, history is written by the winners. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
The UK, home to some of the richest people on the planet. The capital, London, alone, has more billionaires than any other city in the world. That's all according to UK Daily, the Sunday Times Rich List. In this country, it says 250 people now own a combined $886 billion, enough to lift millions out of extreme poverty several times over.
It clearly shows that the capitalist system is not working. And obviously, we are celebrating that there are so many more millionaires who have more than doubled or tripled their wealth in the last 2 years, while the poor have become really even poorer.
Many of the names on the list have been there for years. This year, though, two new faces. Chancellor Rishi Sunak, the man in charge of helping millions of struggling British families through the spiraling cost of living crisis, and his wife.
Evidently, someone of his wealth has no understanding of the crisis that a majority of the people are facing. We have 4 million people going to food banks, and the crisis, the cost of living crisis, is becoming very significant. By the end of the year, the ordinary people, the poorer sections of the community, may be even in more difficulty while Mr. Rishi Sunak is laughing all the way to the bank.
The bulk of Rishi Sunak's wealth stems from his wife, the daughter of an Indian IT mogul. He also made his fortune working for Goldman Sachs and as a hedge fund manager in the past. We wanted to know how Britons felt about their chancellor now being one of the 250 wealthiest people in the country amidst the cost of living crisis that's pushing millions of people into poverty.
I believe it's not fair, particularly the way we found out suddenly out of the blue.
I don't feel particular resentment at people who have money, as long as they do their job and do their job well. No one would have known had not it been highlighted recently.
First published in 1989, the Sunday Times Rich List bears the names of 1,000 ultra-rich people or families resident in the United Kingdom. 90% of those on the list are usually men.
At a time of record inflation, when many are struggling with energy bills, petrol prices and food costs, this golden era for the UK's super rich, among them now a government official, does not seem to be coming to an end. Saeed Pour is up, London.
U.S. President Joe Biden met South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol for summit talks in Seoul Saturday. The conservative Yoon seeks to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance. Biden's remarks perhaps fell short of the strategic nuclear umbrella the hawkish Yoon seeks, while offering some reassurance regarding North Korea's missile and nuclear programs.
Today, President Yoon and I committed to strengthening our close engagement and work together to take on challenges of regional security, including addressing the threat posed by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, by further strengthening our deterrence posture and working toward a complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Several demonstrations took place throughout the day outside the summit venue. Peace activists worry Yoon's hasty actions to embrace Washington endanger regional peace and security.
Strengthening the U.S.-South Korea alliance will likely cause a backlash from North Korea, China, and Russia and destabilize the security of South Korea. If we jump on the U.S. strategy too easily, will this really protect the economy and security of South Korea?
Presidents Yoon and Biden also toured a Samsung Electronics factory. Biden plans to launch the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework in Tokyo next week as the U.S. implements the new trade grouping largely aimed at containing China. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is just 10 days into his five-year term in office. Through this summit with U.S. President Joe Biden, Seoul has now strongly pivoted to a more pro-American foreign policy. The question then is how U.S. adversaries in the region, China and North Korea, will react. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Outrage has spread across the pro-Palestine community this week after British Home Secretary Priti Patel branded the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions movement racist and anti-Semitic. The controversial comments were issued on Monday at a Conservative Friends of Israel lobby group event.
The BDS movement, everything we have seen around the BDS movement is racist. The anti-Semitic troops, the cartoons, the chants.
Founded in 2005, the BDS movement is a Palestinian-led campaign promoting boycott and economic sanctions against Israel. After a notable rise in popularity and success in recent years, the British establishment has acted to essentially criminalise the practice. In response to Patel's comments, onlookers have pointed out her own policies and praise of Israel's ambassador as blatant hypocrisy.
The hypocrisy of Priti Patel calling anyone or anything racist on one hand, whilst openly gushing for Tzipi Hotovli on the other. I mean, Tzipi is an out-and-out anti-Arab racist. She thinks that Jews and Arabs should have no relationships at all. She also thinks that the Nakba, the expulsion of 700,000 Palestinians at the birth of Israel, she thinks that was a myth. Secondly, Priti Patel herself, her comments against Black Lives Matter, against English footballers who took the knee against in solidarity against racism, and also the laws that she's brought into place, like the Nationality and Borders Act. These comments, these laws, they've further, deeper, structuralised racism into British society.
In addition to the anti-BDS remarks, Patel laid bare her so-called unflinching support to Israel. This comes just days after the shock killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhila by Israeli regime forces, making it appear that no matter what crimes are being committed, Tel Aviv can rely on unwavering support from the British Home Office. Robert Carter, London.
In the limelight.
The shot came midway through the speech. Reparation, boomed Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's firebrand president, to the cheers of farmers, working students who had gathered in the crowd. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Constant Mahout, Catherine Porter, Salam Gebrekidan, and Matt Apuzzo. The piece is titled, A Haitian President Tried to Hold France to Account for Its Years of Exploitation. He soon found himself ousted from power. The shock came midway through the speech. Reparation, boomed Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's firebrand president, to the cheers of the farmers, workers and students who had gathered in the crowd. The French ambassador to Haiti, sitting on stage, hid his alarm behind an awkward smile. He knew Mr. Aristide well enough to expect barbs at Haiti's former French colonizers and slave masters. But on that day, on 7th of April 2003, the president suddenly started calling for reparations, a bombshell that became a hallmark of his presidency, and diplomats now concede part of his undoing. We had to try to defuse it, the French ambassador to Haiti, Yves Goudoul, said of Mr. Aristide's call for reparations, calling it an explosive. With his remarks, Jean-Bertrand Aristide tried to excavate a history that remains all but buried in France. Long after Haitians threw off their shackles, beat Napoleon's forces and won their independence 2 centuries ago, France came back with warships and an unheard-of demand that the people of Haiti pay astounding amounts of money to their former slave masters or face war again. Haiti became the first and only nation in the world to pay reparations to its former slave masters and their descendants for generations. According to a New York Times analysis of thousands of pages of archival documents, it shipped the equivalent of hundreds of millions of dollars to France, setting off a cycle of perpetual debt that sapped Haiti's ability to build a nation for more than 100 years. Yet, to this day, that history is not taught in French schools, and many of the country's most prominent aristocratic families are unaware that their ancestors kept collecting payments from Haiti's poorest people long after the end of slavery in Haiti. Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's first democratically elected president after decades of dictatorship, wanted France to do far more than acknowledge its past. He wanted restitutions from Paris. what beautiful schools, universities and hospitals we'll be able to build for our children, he told the crowd. How much food we will have in abundance. The consequences were immediate and lasting. In interviews, a dozen French and Haitian political figures recounted how a worried France worked quickly and doggedly to stifle Jean-Bertrand Aristide's call for reparations before siding with his opponents and collaborating with the United States to remove Aristide from power. France and the United States have long said that Jean-Bertrand Aristide's call for restitution had nothing to do with his ouster, that he had taken an autocratic turn, lost control of the country, and was spirited into exile to prevent Haiti, already heaving with turmoil, from careening into chaos. But France's ambassador to Haiti at the time, Thierry Burkhard, conceded in an interview that France and the United States had effectively orchestrated a coup d'etat against Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and that his abrupt removal from power was probably a bit about his call for reparations from France as well. It made our job easier to dismiss the reparations claim without Jean-Bertrand Aristide in office, Thierry Burkhard noted. The showdown underscores how, 2 centuries after France forced the Haitians to pay their former slave masters for the liberty they had already won in battle, the effects continue to ripple through the politics of both countries. By calling for restitution, Haiti, a nation born from what historians called the world's most successful slave rebellion, struck at France's national identity as a beacon of human rights and threatened to inspire other nations with historical grievances against France to follow its lead, nations in the Caribbean and in Africa. We were very disdainful of Haiti, the French ambassador Yves Godwell recalled. What I think we will never forgive Haiti for, deep down, is that it is the country that beat us. Even after Jean-Bertrand Aristide's removal of power in 2004, the calls for restitution have continued to reverberate, leading to a stunning concession more than a decade later by François Hollande, France's former president, who referred to the money Haiti was forced to hand over as ransom of independence. Since then, scholars have increasingly explored the history of Haiti's payments. Just this past December, at a conference on the grounds of the French Finance Ministry, one of the most prominent French historians on relations between the two countries, Jean-François Brière, called the payments a form of meta-slavery that prevented Haiti from breaking free of France long after independence. All French people are affected by the nation's past in Haiti, said Jean-Marc Ayrault, a former French prime minister. Yet, Ayrault said, French students don't learn about it and few officials discuss it. It's never taught in France, he said. It's never explained. Mr. Yves Godwell, France's former ambassador to Haiti, wanted to negotiate. Jean-Bertrand Aristide's sudden call for restitution was a political hand grenade, he feared, threatening to embarrass France on the world stage and rip apart relations between the two countries. Yet, Jean-Bertrand Aristide's stance was not unreasonable, he recalled thinking. He wasn't wrong to say how much harm it had done to his country, Mr. Godwell said of France's history in Haiti, and to ask France for compensation in turn. The former French ambassador to Haiti, Yves Godwell, said he urged the French government at the time to open discussions with Haiti to help defuse the situation, but was firmly rejected. I didn't understand how we could be so stupid, Mr. Godwell said. Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a polarizing figure who rose to office as a champion of the poor, knew his campaign was contentious and had timed it for maximal impact. He announced his demand on the 200th anniversary of the death of Toussaint Louverture, the Haitian revolutionary leader seized by Napoleon Bonaparte's forces and carted off to prison in France, where he died without a trial. Why, after 200 years, is Haiti this impoverished? Jean-Bertrand Aristide said in a recent interview at his home in a suburb of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. One of the reasons, he said, was the enormous amount of money that Haiti has been forced to hand over to France for generations, a heavy burden often called the independence debt. Mr. Aristide uncovered this history only after he had already been ousted from office the first time, his aide said, when a military coup d'etat deposed him in 1991 and forced him into exile in the United States. He began immersing himself in the growing scholarship on a history that even as Haiti's president, he knew little about. After the Americans helped restore him to power, he was re-elected in 2000 and intensified his research into Haiti's past. He would call many times asking for more information, recalled Dr. Francis Saint-Hubert, a Haitian physician who had studied the links between the abysmal state of public health in Haiti and the money siphoned off by France. On the bicentennial anniversary, Jean-Bertrand Aristide upped the political ante by declaring the precise amount he said France owed Haiti. $21,685,135,571. French diplomats and some Haitians mocked the multi-billion-dollar figure as a misguided publicity stunt by a demagogue trying to maintain his grip on power. A group of 130 Haitian intellectuals denounced the restitution campaign as a desperate attempt to distract attention from the Jean-Bertrand Aristide government's totalitarian drift, incompetence and corruption. A French foreign ministry spokesman said France did not need to take lessons from Haiti's leaders. But a New York Times analysis of the long-term damage done by sending enormous sums of money to France shows that Haiti's losses may have been surprisingly close to Jean-Bertrand Aristide's figure of $21.68 billion. In fact, his estimate may have been a bit modest. The New York Times scoured thousands of pages of archival government documents to determine how much Haiti sent to France over the course of generations, not just in official payments to former slaveholders, but also for a loan to help pay them. The New York Times found that Haiti paid France a total of $560 million in today's dollars. But that only begins to account for the loss. With the help of 15 leading economists from around the world, we modelled what might have happened if that money had gone into the Haitian economy, rather than being siphoned off to France without getting any goods or any services in return. The New York Times' estimates found that over time, the payments to France cost Haiti from $21 billion to $115 billion in lost economic growth. Put in perspective, that is anywhere from 1 to 8 times the size of Haiti's entire economy in 2020. "We were building a path to the truth," Jean-Bertrand Aristide said in the interview, without being told the outcome of the New York Times' analysis.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
President Biden has announced that the U.S. would respond militarily if China attacked Taiwan. China said in response that no country should underestimate its firm resolve and strong ability to protect its sovereign and territorial interests. Beijing also urged Washington to stop saying or doing things in violation of the One China principle. China has also threatened those who play with fire will certainly burn themselves. The United States and China are already at odds over a myriad of issues as regards technology, trade, Hong Kong, and South China Sea. Now, what about Taiwan? Are the two powers heading for a collision over Taiwan? Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let me introduce our guests in tonight's episode of The Spotlight. We'll have retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel and former Pentagon analyst Karen Kiatowski from Mount Jackson, Virginia. Also, the spokesman of the LaRouche organization, Harley Schlanger, joining us from Potsdam, Germany.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show. Let's begin with Karen. Good to have you with us. So American war planners had previously left the question of U.S. defending Taiwan against Chinese aggression unanswered. But now you have President Biden openly saying that his country will take military action in that case. So does he really mean it? What has changed?
It's hard to say if he means it or not. I think actually the president does mean it. He imagines himself to be a king, I think. And I don't think he reads the small print. I don't think he understands the agreements. He is a person who likes to use threatening language, and he uses it.
Mm-hmm. And then we have this state-run Chinese newspaper, The Global Times, saying that Biden's remarks are not gaffes but dangerous signals that the U.S. intends to drop support of the One China policy. So how do you see the future relations between Washington and Beijing?
The current relations aren't as good as they should be, and the future relations could very well get worse. And I think part of what Biden is indicating and why his staff is allowing him to indicate these things is to actually create a kind of ambiguity beyond the normal support of One China policy, but an ambiguity on the use of military force. And the question was asked of the president this time. This is the third time in 9 months that he has made such a statement about coming to the full defense of Taiwan. And all three times the staff has walked him back from that. But this question recently was in context of the Ukrainian defense, the $40 billion that were just the United States Congress just gave to or voted to give to Ukraine, and also the $20 billion before that, it has already been committed to Ukraine. So this is a large military response, and that's what Biden is imagining that he would do in a case of Taiwan. I think in his mind, he would do that.
Okay. Now, Harley is also joining us from Germany. Harley, good to have you with us. So this state-owned paper, the Global Times in China, is saying that China-U.S. relationship is like Titanic, and it's heading for an iceberg. I wonder if you agree with that.
Oh, absolutely. And it's almost entirely the fault of the war party in the United States. We've seen an escalation of rhetoric regarding Russia in Ukraine, and now we're seeing the same thing in China. The intention after the withdrawal from Afghanistan was to carry out a pivot to Asia, which includes the Quad, which includes the idea of an Asian NATO, which included the AUKUS agreement, the Australia-UK-US nuclear sub-agreement. You have Admiral Richard, the chairman of STRATCOM, saying that the US is now more likely to use nuclear weapons than it had been in the past. There's an illusion that exists within the top advisors around Biden, which is that U.S. military power is invincible. And I think they actually are working on war plans for limited nuclear war, preemptive strikes with Russia and China. And in our view, it's completely insane. But it is this view of the unipolar world that the U.S. can dictate with its NATO allies, who really don't bring much to the table except for the British, who actually are part of the crafting of these plans.
Mm-hmm. Harley, we had this reporter asking President Biden that the U.S. did not get involved in Ukraine militarily. What if Taiwan is attacked? And then Biden says, yes, the U.S. would take military action in that case. Now, this is while in his recent Asian trip, he signed agreements with a dozen countries to join the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. So doesn't this send some kind of mixed signals? I mean, speaking of war, at the same time clinching trade deals in Asia, what's Washington's agenda in Asia?
Well, first of all, no deals were actually signed. There are no agreements. It was an agreement to reach an agreement, the so-called Indo-Pacific agreement. A number of the Asian nations are hesitant because they're watching what the U.S. is doing in Ukraine, where, look, I would say the U.S. is virtually a co-belligerent. The weapons that are being delivered have made a bit of a difference to help Ukraine. But more importantly, they're trying to bleed Russia. I think the same intention exists with China. But you have to realize the issue of trade is a phony issue. If the U.S. wanted more trade in Asia, it could join the Belt and Road Initiative. It's been invited to do that. Mm-hmm. What it's trying to do is contain China and stop China's aggressive commitment to infrastructure and development. And that's because the whole Western financial system depends on cheap labor and cheap raw resources from the poorer countries of the world.
All right. Let's turn to Harley now. Harley, I want you to answer the same question, please. It's an important one. Let our viewers know your opinion about what Washington's true intention is and what's the plan for Asia.
Well, the plan is to stop China. The intention is to make sure that you can continue favorable trade agreements for the United States, in other words, for global corporations from the United States to get cheap labor agreements, to get a supply chain from poorer Asian countries. But the Chinese, which used to do that, have changed. And that's a significant change. Now, the second significant change is the China-Russia agreement. The fact that China and Russia are agreeing not just on military, but on economic policy. You know, one of the important things, and I know many people in Iran know this, one of the important aspects shaping Western policy is the idea of preventing an alliance between Eurasian economic development and Europe. And this is what the Ukraine situation is about, and this is what the China situation is about. Mm-hmm. This goes back to British geopolitics and Mackinder in 1904, and the fact that Russia and China are integrating Eurasia with Eastern Europe or Russia, and that this is very attractive to people in Germany who otherwise are suffering under the sanctions policy. If Germany were to join with Russia and China, it would be game over for the City of London and Wall Street to be able to dictate economic terms globally.
Okay, Karen, you know that Washington has a close relationship with Taiwan, but officially it pursues the one China policy, and President Biden also confirmed this. Now, there is no official ties between the U.S. and Taiwan, but Washington sells weapons to Taiwan. It has, great trade relations with it. Is this not contradictory to the one China principle that Washington is saying that it's sticking with?
It is. It is somewhat contradictory, but, there's money to be made in Taiwan, and it certainly serves an American purpose to irritate China in that regard. I wanted to agree with what Farley said and add one thing to it as far as the nuclear threat. Biden, after this, went to South Korea and renewed a statement of shared defense, and for the first time ever used the word nuclear in his range of weapons that we would use to defend South Korea. So this idea that nuclear war is being planned for is well documented. Of course, the Pentagon has published documents. RAND Corporation has published documents on the winnability of a nuclear war. But this is clearly something that is out there. Biden is talking about it. He is hinting at it. And I think we have to take him seriously. I am concerned, of course, that Washington is willing to blow up the entire world to destroy it, to achieve its aims.
Mm-hmm. And Karen, let's also talk a little bit about the so-called Quad Group, the U.S., Japan, Australia, and India. And, this has kind of alarmed Beijing. What's the plan?
I think, the world is changing. We've got the multipolar power sharing future, which the United States is unwilling to really cope with. We're not going to tolerate that, or Washington, D.C. is not going to. So much of what passes for our foreign policy is really a war against a multipolar world, which cannot be stopped. It's already well down the road, not just with military cooperation, economic cooperation, but also financial cooperation, which we're seeing right now in with China and Russia and many of the other countries in dealing with U.S. sanctions.
Mm-hmm. Harley, Chinese President Xi Jinping has said that reunification between China and Taiwan is inevitable, and he refused to rule out the use of force. So what's the prospect like for the two countries?
Well, I think the Chinese do not want to have a war over Taiwan. There were significant developments of improved trade relations, economic investment in Taiwan from China. Mutual cooperation in artificial intelligence and other areas. But this, as Karen was saying, this irritates Washington, which seems to believe that all trade must flow from Washington and London, or from Wall Street and London. And the fact that China has become a major economic power is the real problem, because the unipolar world, which people in Washington swear loyalty to, is based on the idea that no other country can dictate terms of trade. And the idea of the Great Reset is an intention of putting all the power in the hands of central banks, which really represent private banks and private corporate cartels. And the idea that China can work with poorer countries, as in Africa, in South Asia, even in Latin America. In the Caribbean nations are opening ties with China, and the State Department is going crazy over this. So It really is the emergence of a multipolar world. It's unstoppable. The only thing they can do is blow it up. And I think that's why you're seeing a reaction, which I think from Washington is seen in many capitals as panic over losing the unipolar world, and over the fact that with inflation, with supply chain problems and other things, the Western economies are in terrible shape.
Mm-hmm. Now let me put the same question to Karen. Karen, what do you see on the horizon for China and Taiwan? Would there be a war, or would there be reunification at any price, like President Xi Jinping is saying?
I don't see reunification. I agree with Harley. I think between those two are to come together to have trade. Even as China, despite some of the things we've seen with the COVID-19 response, even China is in some ways listening to its people more, that kind of thing. Being a more integrated democracy, it's not a democracy, but they listen to their people. So it's not even the stereotypical dictatorship or communist state anymore. That doesn't exist over there in that regard. So I think a peaceful coming together and a profitable coming together is down the road, but I think it'll take a lot of time. You're talking, honestly, generational. If you don't do it via war, you have to do it when the culture itself changes, and I think that culture is changing, and it's going to take time, and I'm sure the Chinese are willing to wait for that.
Mm-hmm. And Harley, China and Russia conducted joint military drills today. It lasted 13 hours. Of course, they're saying that this is routine practice. So what signal does that send to Washington and its allies in Asia?
Well, you know, I was talking to some people around the Pentagon recently, and they acknowledged that their whole plan for military confrontation was always based on the idea of either war with Russia or war with China, but not a two-front war. And this, of course, blows everything out of the water for them. Because the idea that the United States would have to carry out operations in the Pacific and with Russia, it doesn't work. I mean, the United States had trouble maintaining forces and control in Afghanistan. So I think the problem that people in Washington have is that they tend to see things as military first. The February 4th meeting between Putin and Xi Jinping was primarily about economic integration, a coordination. And the military was secondary, but they knew that if they came closer together economically, it would provoke a reaction from the U.S. and NATO against them. And so, of necessity, they have to be prepared militarily. But it's also clear that Washington's policies are driving much of the rest of the world into a distrust of the dollar and the U.S. The U.S. just stole $30 billion from Russia. China is trying to figure out how to pull some of its investments in the United States out before it faces the same kind of problem. So in all of this, Washington is the problem. And I think unless something changes dramatically, and of course you have a bipartisan consensus on these policies in Washington, we may be in it for a long, long war.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of the show. Let me thank our guests. We had retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Kellen and former Pentagon analyst Karen Kwiatkowski from Mount Jackson, Virginia. Also, spokesman of the LaRouche organization, Harley Schlanger, joined us from Potsdam, Germany. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
We'll be right back.